This is an audio archive edition of Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network.
Right now,
we can meet our destiny to build a land here that will be for all mankind a shining city on a hill.
With best-selling author and political analyst, Coy Barefoot.
We are in studio speaking with the one, the only Ray Berry. If you've been around this town for any length of time, you know Ray. Ray started at UVA in 55 and was over here at WCHV, which of course is now WINA. And, well, that's not true. It's all been moved around. The WCHV building is now WINA, although there is now still a WCHV up near Pepsi Place. And, of course, now, Ray, you were out in October 30th, 1959, you were out in the field covering a football game for WCHV.
Right. The people who had been covering football for WCHV, high school football this is, had the fellow who was doing the color was transferred down to Danville to manage a station that the new owners of WCHV had recently bought. So they needed somebody to do the color during the high school football game, and since I was a staff announcer, I got the assignment. I didn't know anything about high school color, football color, but that didn't matter. Later I did UVA basketball color, didn't know anything about that either, but if you're a staff announcer, you do those things.
So you were out where?
I was out at Albemarle High School football field, and it was the night that the Barracks Road Shopping Center had opened.
That was the grand opening of the Barracks Road Shopping right. Center. Of course, right. This is October 30th, 1959. It was sort of overcast, very overcast that night, a little chilly.
Hugely overcast. Yeah. And above us, we could see these enormous floodlights, spotlights, bouncing off the clouds because they had those as part of the Barracks Road Center's grand opening.
Like you see at a movie opening.
Right. Yeah. And about 8:30 or so, we heard an airplane, very low, flying from east to west. And that's a route that in those days, no commercial plane ever flew. And during a commercial break, I remarked to the fellow who was doing the play-by-play, and I'm trying to remember his name, it'll come to me, that it sounded like a plane was lost. And he heard it, and he said, yeah, it does. Well, that was it. It's about all we... And it died out, and we paid no attention. I got back to the station about 9:30, quarter to 10. And at 10:15, I called the Charlottesville Albemarle Airport to ask if a plane was overdue. And there was silence at the other end. And then they said, we can't comment on that. So at 12, when we closed the station, I lived in Prophet, which is about 6 miles northeast of the station, and I could go home by way of Route 20, or I could go up 29 and then over the Prophet Road. So that night I went up 29. But instead of going to the Prophet Road, I went to the airport, and it was a buzz with people there who, and obviously they had lost a plane. So I got in the car, and I drove home, and I got a toothbrush and an electric razor and a change of underwear, and I went back to the airport. I got there about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I left, that was on Friday night, Saturday morning, and I left there in the middle of Sunday. I just stayed out at the airport.
And, of course, what they lost was,
DC-10?
It was
a Piedmont Fairchild F-27, I think, was the plane.
And this was the first major airline
This was the first crash Piedmont ever had.
And certainly the first for Charlottesville in this area.
Right, because we'd been serviced by Piedmont. Piedmont had never had a plane crash before. I think that they had lost a passenger who got a door open or something and fell out. But this was the first plane they ever had that crashed. The next day, Saturday, we had the Civil Air Patrol and various others out searching for a downed plane. We knew at that point which flight it was and how many people were on it and who they were. But nobody knew where it was. And there were some reports coming in from various parts of the county, especially near Afton Mountain, that a plane had been heard, but nobody knew exactly where it was. So the CAP and the others were crisscrossing, doing a grid search, trying to find this thing. And when they couldn't find it, a couple of helicopters came up from both the Navy and the Air Force sent helicopters up from their bases in Virginia. When the Air Force helicopters came in, I got a hold of one of the fellows who was flying one and asked if I could go up with them on the search. And they said, no, we can't do that. And I said, well, it would really help because I know the roads here. I live here. And if you find this thing and spot this thing, you won't know what it's near. You won't be able to identify how to get there. And I can help on that. And he said, okay, sign a release. So I was up in the chopper from 2 o'clock until dark. We couldn't find a thing. Nobody did. The next morning, bright and early, a chopper takes off, but not mine. And it turns out that every 100 hours, these things needed servicing, and mine needed service. So we were going to be on the ground at least a half hour. And I'm cursing my luck that I'm not up there because, you know, obviously it's going to be found. It can't be, but so far away.
And just to set the scene, the whole, I mean, this entire area is focused on this search for this plane because it had, what, 50 people or something like that?
Yeah, 27. There's 27. Hundreds, right? There's hundreds of people around the airport. Every press service, there are people from New York newspapers who are down here. Every wire service
DC,
is down here.
I mean,
TV stations.
And everybody's just walking out
radio.
Across their fields looking for bits of airplane wreckage.
Right, right. But yeah. And most of these guys are hanging around the airport getting their news from those people who are, you know, passing out news at the airport. They've got one spokesman.
Yeah.
And they're interviewing people from the CAP, and they're trying to find picks, holes to pick here and nits to pick there, and, you know, the usual things that the press has to do to make it interesting.
Right. Let's continue this story on the other side of the break. We're talking with Ray Berry. Been in Charlottesville quite a while, and this is the story of Charlottesville's first plane crash, first big plane crash, and one of Virginia's first.
Hey, I'm an Arivist. I wasn't born here.
Let's take a break. This is Charlottesville right now.
This is Charlottesville right now.
We're in studio speaking with the one, the only Ray Berry. Ray, you're telling a story about one of Piedmont Airlines' first plane crash,
yes,
and the first big one here in Charlottesville, in central Virginia, back in October, the night of October 30th, 1959. It was the night that Barracks Road Shopping Center opened, and that they were having a big, big celebration out there. And this plane that was due into the Charlottesville airport just didn't show up.
Didn't show up.
And big search goes on all that weekend. This is national news of a plane crash in Virginia.
Right. They could not find the plane, and the longer they looked for it, the more it became a major event around the country. I had radio stations in Oregon and Washington that had hired me to give them feeds on the news. The reason I was there was because I was entertainment for WCHV. There were no newsmen at the station in those days, and they had no news department. So I was there for just because I was interested. Incidentally, I got paid for the weekend because I did spend 2.5 days out there. I got
$10. $10 to help search for the airplane.
$10 from WCHV's management for that weekend.
Now,
anyway.
Now, let's get back to the story. What's great, and folks need to know what's great about this, and you're going to get to it, is you were the guy that found the plane.
I found the plane, and I found the survivor. The while the helicopter that I was on was being serviced, word came in they had seen a flash on the side of Afton Mountain, and they knew pretty much where it was. So the first helicopter to take off was mine. On board was Rip Payne, a photographer with the Daily Progress and a freelancer, a state trooper whose name I don't recall, somebody from the Civil Aeronautics Board, and myself. We landed on the flat top mountain, and fanned off down the side trying to find the plane.
It was specifically, excuse me for interrupting, this was Buck's Elbow Mountain, right?
Buck's Elbow Mountain, yeah. Right. Yeah, thank you. I'd forgotten. I forget a lot of things these days. It was thickly wooded and very steep. It had to be at least a 25% grade, maybe more. And strewn with boulders, thickly wooded. We went down about 200 yards, and nobody found it. So the state trooper called over, Slick, calling to me, and I have never forgotten. I loved it, Slick. How about going on up? Get the chopper to hover over it so we could find it. Well, in those days, I could turn around and run up a 25% slope and get to the top. But as I did, the chopper left, and I wasn't able to get his attention, so we didn't have that. So I turned around and ran back down the hill and stumbled right into the wreckage. And the first thing I heard was a voice that said, "Don't step on that stick." And that's when I found out that there was a survivor. You know, that's the first time in plane crash history that everybody aboard but one was killed.
Really?
Philip Bradley set a new record. And I think since then there have been more than just Phil. So I went over and I interviewed Bradley. Of course, I didn't have a tape recorder because we had no news department.
You went over and helped him, is what you should say. First, you helped him.
No, you can't help him. He was lying in a chair on a stick. He couldn't get out of his seat. His hip was broken. He was in November nights for what was 36 hours exposure. So he wasn't in good shape. I was not a trained nurse or medical person. I wasn't going to touch him.
So you ran over and stuck a microphone in his face?
I didn't have one. We didn't have microphones. We had no tape recorders. This was not a news department. I was just there on my own taking notes.
And why did he say, as you're walking through the woods and you just hear this voice, "Don't step on that stick"?
He was resting on the end of a broken tree branch, which was sticking out about 30 feet, and I had been about to step on it.
Which would have jostled his chair and sent him down the mountain.
It's just he had a busted hip.
Oh, okay.
And he was in great pain.
And when you saw him and the plane crash?
Him, right. And, so
and was the whole fuselage just broken apart?
In pieces. And all the bodies were out there. Everybody had come out straight through the front of it, straight into the ground. Everybody very dead. And he had come in and come out and kind of bounced on the others. And that's what saved him. Everybody else was pretty well softened up, as it were.
And he was just stuck in his chair. He couldn't get out.
Couldn't get out. Too much pain from the broken hip.
And when you've told me the story before, one thing that really stuck out in my memory was you said there were shoes everywhere.
That's what happens in a plane crash, and I'd heard about that, but this time I saw it. Everybody was barefoot, in socks.
And people may not know that. In a plane crash or a train crash, you lose your shoes because the bodies are knocked around so roughly.
The plane came into the ground at about a 60-degree angle, which was enough to knock everybody's shoes off. Anyway, so I called to the state trooper, and he had a radio, and at that point we began to get the rescue people in there. What was fascinating from a news standpoint was that I went back up to the hill after I'd seen everything at the scene and talked to Phil, and I got back on a chopper and went back to the airport, and I had to phone in a news story, of course, to WCHV and to about a half a dozen others that asked me to do some stringing. And there was a long line of people at the single phone booth. So I walked up to the front of the line and talked to the first guy who was there, and I said, "I've been to the site. I talked to the survivor. I'll help you do your newscast if you let me in behind you." And he said, "Fair enough." That man was the news director of the hell's the name of that station in Richmond? It's the biggest station in Richmond.
WTVR?
No.
Or is that in
radio? RVA, WRVA. He was the news director down there. And he was a wonderful, experienced, superb newsman. He put together a 15-minute radio show called And Then There Was One, on the spot, doing it with interviews. When he was done, it was probably the greatest news event in Virginia because of his beautiful way of dramatizing it. So he left, and I made the phone calls to WCHV and to all these others, and then went home. Somebody with no news experience scoops the entire press corps that was down there. Now that's to be ultimate beginner's luck, because I couldn't have been more stupid. As a newsman, I had no idea what I was doing. But every time I turned around, there was the right door to go through.
Ray Berry, our guest, former Charlottesville radio reporter and Daily Progress reporter. And we're talking about October 1959, the first big plane crash in Central Virginia, Piedmont Airlines' first crash right here in Charlottesville. The plane landed up on Buck's Elbow Mountain. And there's a historic marker out there at Mint Spring Park.
There is. About 4 years ago, some money was collected to build a monument. And there was a memorial service out there at Mint Springs Park, and Phil was there and spoke, and George Bailey talked about some of the experiences of things from the Sheriff's Department at that day, and it was a very pleasant afternoon to remember, and you could see the site from Mint Springs Park.
I've actually read the Federal Aviation's investigation report of this plane crash.
I have that too.
And it was they just literally they got lost.
Yeah.
They missed a transponder or something that's supposed to beep and tell them where to turn, and they missed it.
A lot of people would say that the conclusions in that report are false, and I'm one of them. There was a lot more going on than they suggest in there, and it didn't just involve the fact that that Captain Lavrink was having some personal problems and other things that were cited in there. The problems with that plane were problems with the airport and with guidance at that time. But
you mean the technology itself was pretty poor?
The technology and the implementation and the fact that we didn't have at Charlottesville Albemarle Airport things we should have had.
Which they got thereafter.
Which they got thereafter.
Right,
but
right.
The Civil Aeronautics Board, which existed in those days, did not want to come to the conclusion of what it was because that meant they were somewhat to blame.
Right. Ray, before we go to a break, let me ask you. You were a kid at the time. I mean, you're a UVA student working in, you know, reporting for a radio station, 1959.
I was 22.
22. Still a kid when you're talking about coming upon an airplane crash with 20-some-odd bodies lying around. What was that like?
You know, it was not different. It was just another experience. I had been doing some news work just for the fun of it before that. On nights when I had nothing else to do, I'd go out and visit wrecks and things like that. I had been to the basement of the medical school one afternoon and came upon some vivisection that was going on there, let's say, and enjoyed watching it.
So you'd seen dead bodies
those
before.
Those things just don't bother me.
Well, you're a better man than I.
You know, flowing blood, you think is going to be one of those things that can really bother you the first time that you see it. For some reason, it didn't. I don't know why.
Why? What did the lone survivor tell you when you ran over to him and you found him up there on that mountainside?
He wanted to know if, first of all, where was his rescue? Because he had been hearing planes fly overhead for 2 days and was wondering why nobody was getting to him and wanted to make sure that people knew he was there. And he was quick to tell me that there were no other survivors, that he was the only one.
I guess he knew after having been out there days and nights.
Yeah, I mean, he'd
in the woods surrounded by bodies.
Right, he'd been calling people. He was worked for a labor union, lived in Roanoke, and was a highly religious man before that, and you can imagine how much more religious he was afterwards.
Ray Berry, our guest. This is Charlottesville, right now. We have enjoyed speaking with Ray Berry in this last hour. Ray has came to Charlottesville in 1955. Is that right, 55?
55.
55 as a UVA student, worked in radio reporting for a long time and wrote for the Daily Progress, telling a great story that I heard years ago when I was doing research for for one of my books and wanted to share that with you. And Ray, I thank you for sharing that with our listeners. You were saying during the break that this plane, when it crashed here in 1959 up on Buck's Elbow Mountain, it actually, if you look at the chart of where the plane was going, they thought they were coming into the airport.
Indeed.
Which is why he was flying so low.
Right. They were on a glide path for the airport, and it was steep, and they came in almost straight into the ground. And then the plane slipped up into the trees, and that's why it disappeared. That's why it took 2 days to find it.
Because it actually hit the ground so hard it went up underneath
the trees.
The trees.
Right. And only the morning sun at about 7:30 or 7:45, shining on the tail for a brief time, revealed where the plane was.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting is local lore had it for many, many years that the reason the plane crashed was those spotlights out at Barrack Road Shopping Center, which was having its grand opening the same night. And, of course, it was ridiculous because it was so overcast that night, the plane couldn't have seen the lights.
Those lights never made it through the clouds.
But I can't tell you how many people, when I was interviewing people for my book, you know, a lot of people around in Charlottesville who were there then, they would look me right in the face and say, well, you know, it's those lights that kill all those people. They were celebrating out at Barrack Road Shopping Center, having their grand opening, and they had these big spotlights, and it drew the plane off course.
From our side of the clouds, it was bright and confusing. From their side of the clouds, there was nothing to be seen.
Yeah, they couldn't have seen it. And, of course, you say one lone survivor. And it was the first time in this country that we'd had a plane crash with just one survivor.
I read it was the first time in the world that was a plane crash with one survivor. I don't know if that's true, but that's what I read.
Wow. Yeah. That's really something. Yeah. So very quickly, you went on from to doing radio there, and we'd love to have you back again. You're a man of many stories. You went did radio there for CHV for many years, and then went over to the Progress for a while.
Well, just about. In 1960, I was reminded that I was supposed to go talk to people about being drafted in the Army. That turns out not to have been a problem, so I came back to town, but I'd quit my job at WCHV, expecting to have to be drafted. But there were no wars, and the Army had far more volunteers than they could ever use. And the train I was on, 90% of those people wanted to go in the service because they had nothing to do. So I came back to Charlottesville and thought I'd come back here to my job. And before I could take this job, I got a phone call from the same fellow who hired me here 4 years before, inviting me to a better job at another station. It seems that the man who founded WELK, Larry Kennedy, sold the station and hired this fellow away to run it, and he wanted me as music director at a whole lot more salary than I was getting from Bob Walker.
Well, that's
at
always nice.
So I went over there, and my last year in radio was over there.
Let's go to Robbie calling in from Albemarle County. Robbie, you're on with Ray Berry. Go right ahead.
Yes, that night of the plane crash, there was a football game at Albemarle High School. And everybody at the football game says they heard that plane go over. It was real foggy. They couldn't see it, but they could hear a plane. So it sounded like it was circling, and then it just left.
Yeah, actually, Ray was out there that night covering the football game and began the story. You may have missed it. He began the story this hour saying that he and the fellow next to him heard this plane flying over, and I guess everybody there at the game heard this lost airplane flying over.
Yeah, right, going west.
You could hear it, but you couldn't see a thing.
Yeah, that's really something. Were you around then, Robbie?
No, my older brother was there.
Yeah, that's really a big story at the time, I guess.
Yes. Yeah.
John Powell was doing the play-by-play that night.
Oh, there you go. Robbie, thanks for calling in. We appreciate it. Please call again. We've been talking with Ray Berry this hour, and really quick, we have only got about a minute left, but we want to have you back on to comment about the article that was in The Hook this week. Charlottesville jump the shark?
Yes.
And
I am dying to talk about that article because that person is so far off base.
Real briefly, tell us why.
Because he's missed the things that made the big difference in Charlottesville probably over its entire life. And that was urban renewal. That was one of the biggest things that changed Charlottesville. Charlottesville didn't jump the shark. Charlottesville has been getting better and better and better. That was one of the things that did it. And the story behind that and how it changed this city is the story that should be told. The article about jumping the shark is fun to read, but there ain't a word of truth in it.
And we'll do that next time here with Ray Berry on Charlottesville right now. This is Coy Barefoot. Glad you could be with us. Ray, thank you, and we'll look forward to having you back very soon.
A pleasure. You are the man of 2 hours and then some. I'm happy to be here for an hour.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. We do it every day, Monday through Friday from 4 to 6, and glad you can join us, dear listener, here in Charlottesville and its environs. It's local talk, local issues, local radio at its very best, only here on News Radio 1070 WINA.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit sevillepodcast.com for more.